You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
So good evening. I'd like to welcome all of you to Open Society Foundations. My name is Mimi Corcoran, and I'm the director of the Special Fund for Poverty Alleviation here at OSF. Tonight, we're delighted to be hosting the conversation with Peter Edelman. He is, without doubt, a remarkable man. I truly have had the great privilege over these past 2 years through his work on disconnected and disadvantaged youth on OSI's behalf at the Georgetown Center for Poverty, Inequality, and Public Policy to get to know Peter. He is truly a champion of those in need. Peter, in his day job, is also a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. He was a top advisor to Senator Robert F. Kennedy from 1964 to 1968, and Peter went on to serve in a senior position in Bill Clinton's administration, where he worked tirelessly on behalf of low-income children and families before resigning in protest after Clinton signed the 1996 welfare reform legislation. I do have to give him a... We're fortunate as well to have Laura Flanders to facilitate tonight's conversation. Laura, as many of you may know, is the host of the Laura Flanders Show, which is currently in development for public television. We're very, very excited about that new effort that you're working on, and look forward to it opening in...
We hope January 13th.
Terrific. She is the host and founder of Grit TV with Laura Flanders, a nationally syndicated daily program on free speech TV, and the host of the Laura Flanders Show and Radio Nation on Air America Radio. Laura is the author of 4 books, and she is a regular contributor to The Nation and MSNBC, and has appeared on shows from Real Time with Bill Maher to The O'Reilly Factor. A couple of technical points this evening. We are recording this event, so please, when you're talking or asking a question, speak into the mic. I'd also like to thank New Press, who for the past 2 decades has provided a unique hybrid model for for-profit publishing and nonprofit advocacy. The New Press has published many of OSI's fellows, such as Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, which is number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list, which is really, really wonderful, as well as other authors and fellows, Ernie Drucker, David Cole, Paul Butler, Nell Bernstein, and Sasha Bromsky, who's writing a book about poverty, which is a special focus of the Special Fund. Before we move to tonight's conversation, I'd just like to take a moment to let you know why this discussion is so important to OSF at this point in time. Back in April of 2009, George Soros created the Special Fund for Poverty Alleviation to help our most vulnerable populations weather the impact of the Great Recession. Our first investment focused on humanitarian relief and provided a one-time $200 back-to-school payment to New York families on public assistance and food stamps, which leveraged the TANF emergency contingency funds. As the crisis continued, Mr. Soros called it an inverted square root. Now, I beg you all to get out your paper and figure out what an inverted square root is. You came across the transom for me. It means that it's going to be deep and long. And so we shifted our focus at the Special Fund to investing in direct service programs that tapped our nation's social safety net in new and more efficient and effective ways to help stabilize the lives of low-income individuals while highlighting gaps in our safety net that needed fixing. Peter so poignantly addresses some of this in his book, such as the availability of cash assistance. And then, to help individuals move from the public economy to the private economy, the Special Fund made investments in programs that would lead to real career pathways so that vulnerable populations could gain the skills, job experience, and education they would need to fully participate in our society. Many of the programs that Peter highlights in his books are those we have invested in: Youth Build, Gateway to College, Year Up, Jobs for the Futures, Back on Track Work in Texas, the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, and the CORE Network. These are programs that provide true opportunities for some of our nation's most vulnerable populations, low-income individuals, immigrants, and communities of color, disconnected youth, and those involved in the criminal justice system. Peter's book encapsulates much of the work that the Special Fund has focused on over the past 3 years, the social safety net, education, workforce development, and the need for these elements to be woven together for the greatest impact. The Special Fund is time-limited, and while we have been a catalytic force for change during the economic crisis, collaborating with government, foundations, businesses, and community-based organizations, we invested $170 million in high-quality programs, we leveraged over $600 million in public and private funding, and have touched over 5 million lives. Despite all that, we recognize that one can't alleviate poverty in the U.S., even spending a large multiple of funds available to OSF and its partners. Rather, it comes down to public will and our shared humanity as a nation to change life outcomes for all of its people, not just some. And so the issues that SPFA has grappled with over the past 3 years are issues Peter has tackled his entire career. We cannot, as Peter so aptly says, allow America and poverty to stand in the same sentences. We have the resources, the intellectual capital, and what we need now is the will to change. There are no simple or single answers. No one in America should be hungry, homeless, or without hope of a pathway leading to opportunity. And so tonight, I very much look forward to the conversation and Peter's insight in how a nation so rich, so poor, can forge a new path for our most vulnerable and create a new narrative for all of us. So please join me in welcoming Laura and Peter.
Thank you, Mimi. What a pleasure. Well, it is an incredible honor to be here with Peter, who I'm one of those people who actually remembers where I was when I heard the news that Peter Edelman had resigned in 1996. Really, it was one of those moments where you just think, this is what we needed. We needed a public, visible leadership role to stand up and say, this doesn't go without public opposition, without public dissent. Frankly, when Jason DePaul, who I know you're a big fan of, wrote in the New York Times this April, his article, Welfare Limits Left Poor Adrift as Recession Hit, I thought a much simpler title would just simply have been, Peter Edelman was right. That would have been my headline choice. Your new book, Peter, is heavy in statistics. It packs an incredible punch, both with numbers and with analysis, and it does present some route from here to someplace else. So don't get discouraged. We will get to the way forward, as Peter does. But I want us to start with the three statistics that you, really any reader of this book, will leave with. And I think they're the statistics you want us to remember. One is that more than half of all the jobs in the U.S. today pay less than $34,000 a year. Another is that a quarter, one in four, of the jobs in the U.S. today pay less than $22,000 a year, which is the poverty line for a family of four. And the final statistic that sticks in my mind is that 16 million of us right now are living on nothing in the way of income and only food stamps. Can you just start, Peter, by putting some flesh on those bones? What does it mean that people are living that way? What does it look like? Paint a picture.
Can I thank you for doing this and thank Mimi and OSF and the New Press for publishing the book, especially. But thanks to everybody who brings us here tonight, Laura, and all of you for coming. Some dear friends, others, new friends. It's just terrific. So why those statistics? There are two different points there. One is how much low-wage work we have in this country. Really astonishing. And the other, 6 million people whose only income is food stamps, and the one that goes along with that, 20 million people who have incomes below half the poverty line, half the poverty, and below $9,000 for a family of three. Those are interconnected because they all relate to how the economy has functioned for people. Those who are at the very bottom often have some other kinds of issues. So you have to start the story in the early 70s in terms of what we all know, that the good jobs, the manufacturing jobs, went away. And were replaced, I suppose we should say we're thankful they were replaced, but by very low-wage jobs. And I don't think we paid enough attention to that in our public discourse and so on. And then along with that, there was the increase that we all know in terms of the number of women who were coping by themselves, having children. Lots to be said, a lot of argument back and forth about what's that all about. But certainly one thing it's about is that it's with all that low-wage work, it's very, very hard for a woman who's bringing up kids to make enough money to have enough to live on. Maybe be out of poverty, but have enough to live on.
How is someone who is only getting by with food stamps actually living? What does that mean for them and their families?
Well, it's terrible. There are a variety of things to say. Some people who themselves have only food stamps. I mean, one way or another, you can't survive on that. So something's got to give. And we are seeing the numbers of the homeless are up. The numbers of families with children, moms with children who are homeless, are up. But if there is a family network, people can cope better. If they have some kind of help with housing. But basically, you have these millions of people. We honestly don't know. In terms of the extremely poor, the people in that 20 million, they're disproportionately in the South, rural, disproportionately African American, to some extent Latino, maybe some farm worker families, things like that, people on Indian reservations. And there are a significant number who are going in and out of deep poverty. And they're not going in and out of poverty, so that when they get out of deep poverty, they only go, they're still poor. So some of it's the dip isn't... Yeah. Isn't permanent, but how in the world would we even stand for the fact that anybody has an income that goes below half the poverty line for a minute? But we do.
What did you think when you were a senior advisor to RFK between 64 and 68? You got food stamps passed, and we'll talk about that. But what did you think the future was going to bring? I mean, looking forward, even a couple of decades, let alone this many, what did you think the U.S. would look like?
You know, I don't know that I thought. I think I assumed to some extent below the level of overt consciousness that we were headed in the right direction as a country on all of this. The 60s, for a variety of reasons, some of it's the program, some of it's the hot economy of that period. Some of it's the result of civil rights and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, where there was a large increase in the employment, especially by city governments and state governments, of African Americans, so that poverty went way down in the 60s. And we had the efforts that we made. David Jones is here. His father and Robert Kennedy worked together on the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation. And we had a lot of sense that the farm workers were organizing and that would be good for wages and for their families. So I think we often have a kind of a view that the future is like the present. And a lot of the time it isn't.
had the pleasure not so long ago of sharing a panel with Paul Fusco, who was a photographer who covered RFK's funeral train. And he describes not knowing what the assignment was going to be, but coming out of Penn Station Tunnel and seeing the people on the side of the tracks, the millions by the end of the trip who had come out to see RFK's body pass. And most of them, when they were interviewed later by a filmmaker, when they were identified in the pictures, they said, we knew that the future hung in the balance. We felt a change was in the air. We hoped, but we also feared. Talk a bit, if you can, about what it was like at that time and what it is like today. For one thing, would food stamps have passed? Would it have passed in our times, do you think? And how did it get passed then?
Well, let's talk about how it got passed then, because it's a great social policy success. And along with many other things, when we hear from people on the right that nothing works, it's one among a list of a lot of things that work. The policies that we have nationally that relate to poverty are keeping 40 million people out of poverty. 40 million more people, more than the 46 million we have right now, would be poor if we didn't have Social Security, food stamps, earned income tax credit, long list of things. So we need to say that. And going back to the earlier conversation and not making a big detour, 40 more million people out of poverty, still 46 million, still that percentage, just because of what's happened to the economy. It's because of all the low-wage jobs. Robert Kennedy went to Mississippi. He saw children who were very hungry. And he came back determined to do something about it. His children will tell you that he came home that night. In their family, it was expected that you would do something to make this a better world. And he pointed his finger at them and said, you have to do something. And that was uncharacteristic because he was so moved by that. He died about a year, a little bit over a year after that. But it did start. There was the country was moved, was ashamed. It was a time, as with the civil rights movement, with Bull Connor and the murders in Mississippi, when national television made a difference in getting the country to react. Dan Shore of CBS was there and covered that day, and it was on television that night. And so George McGovern picked up the mantle on it and chaired the special committee, and there were a lot of pieces to it. CBS had a documentary called Hunger USA that was very, very powerful. There was a citizens' commission on poverty that the Field Foundation funded, and Edgar Kahn worked on that. So there were the Bob Coles and the other docs went down to Mississippi and did examinations of hundreds of kids and discovered just shocking amounts of pernicious anemia, rickets, marasmus, diseases that you would not believe would be in kwashiorkor that would be in the United States. So Richard Nixon was the first president to send a message to Congress asking that food stamps be made into a national program. It was a demonstration program before that, and we went from there. But George McGovern and the field hearings that he had made a huge difference, and so by the mid to late 70s, we had the program we have now, and of course, it's serving 46 million people now. At the beginning of the recession, it was serving 26.3 million people, almost 20 million more people over the course of the last now 4 years or so. And it's making a huge difference in keeping people from even deeper trouble.
Do you think it would pass today?
Right now, I don't know what would pass that would be helpful to anybody that, at least in the way we think about being helpful and constructive. But over the course, when President Obama was elected, in the first 2 years, we passed a health care bill that has Medicaid reaching 16 million more people, a whole large group of adults ages 18 to 64 who weren't covered by Medicaid. It was a big, big hole. Never been able to do that from 1965 on. Race to the Top, where we can argue about some of the policies, but it's a serious effort of national policy to improve education for low-income kids. The Recovery Act had well over $150 billion in it for low-income people. Very serious in the commitment to deal with poverty, even if they didn't kind of say it out loud. The current atmosphere that we have, it is going to take us a way to time to work our way out of it. But in terms of, do I think that it could happen now? You know, George W. Bush liked food stamps.
Right.
He had a deputy secretary of agriculture named Eric Boast, who was terrific. You really, we don't want to be too tough on ourselves about this. Although right now, I mean, right now we got to play defense.
Yeah.
We have Paul Ryan, and Paul Ryan is a threat to this country.
I was going to ask you how real you think the threat to food stamps is specifically.
As long as they can't get 60 votes in the Senate, I think it's food stamps itself is all right. But the effort, it's part of a larger effort. You know, make us fight about this so we don't have to fight about that. So even if they're not going to succeed on food stamps, then they draw our attention to it. So they're trying to say food stamps is the new welfare. You know, I thought it was a program about keeping people from being hungry, but turns out it's the new welfare. Well, they want to turn it into a block grant, I think that's something where there can be success. At, you know, they may succeed with some budget cuts. Let's not kid ourselves. But the overall effort is to dismantle as much as they can, and people have to stand up and speak about that.
In terms of welfare, I went down to North Carolina not long after 1996 and the passage of the Personal Responsibility Act to see what happened in a state that had done away with federal welfare early when a crisis hit. This was Hurricane Hugo. And I saw the administration of the new TANF program in the eastern part of the state. And it was, people told me that it was basically being administered by the old agents of the segregated South. I mean, people knew, oh, that person's family was a Klan member. They left like the day before yesterday. That was an unexpected consequence that I hadn't anticipated. What were some of the other unanticipated consequences of the repeal or the end of welfare support?
Well, I want to say I anticipated them.
Yeah, that's right. You did.
No, I mean, there's two pieces to that. Obviously, in terms of it being useless in a recession, as it's turned out to be, that took whatever that was, 16 years to come to pass. But the fact is it wasn't good from the beginning. It was women did find jobs in significant numbers, yes. The economy was very, very hot. The earned income tax credit was helpful in adding to the wage of low-wage jobs. And so you did get the number of women who were working went from single moms from 49% up to 64%. It's back down to 54%. But 40% of the people who, I'm talking the old news now, from 97 on, 40% of the people who went off welfare did not get a job. So there were problems from the beginning, and they were kind of masked. The Democrats had because the president had put them in sort of a position where what did he do? He triangulated anyway. A lot of people voted for it who maybe knew better, but they're stuck with it. So they have to say it's a big success. And they still say that. Anyway, to get us to where we are right now, it's now essentially, this goes back to the 6 million people with only food stamps, because if you were going to have a decent safety net, even modestly decent, you have to have both the food stamps and you have to have cash assistance for these families. If we just had that on some kind of that combination, in most states, people would not be in deep poverty. Although in Mississippi and some others, Mississippi, even if you have both food stamps and welfare, you have 40% income at 40% of the poverty line. That's with that. And in Mississippi, they have about 10%, 11% of the children, of the poor children, get welfare. In Wyoming, in 2010, it's about the same now, 644 people in the entire state of Wyoming on TANF, 4% of the poor children, 4%. 19 states where less than 10% of the children are receiving TANF. It's gone. And you still have these politicians who are standing up and vaying and saying, oh, there are too many people on welfare. Well, show me, you know. Show me where they are. Now, it's not every state. California does a pretty good job, although much less so with their terrible cuts and some others. But it's when you have 4 million people left on welfare after everything in the middle of a recession, and people went to the welfare officer, maybe didn't even bother. I mean, notice the difference between food stamps and the welfare. Food stamps went from 26.3 million to 46 million because there's a legal right to have it. Food stamps went from 3.9 million to 4.4 million because there's no legal right to have it.
Welfare. Yeah. Well, that was what made the difference in North Carolina. Welfare, the second time.
Yeah.
In North Carolina, because those people administering it made it very hard to get it.
Yes, yeah.
And they were actually rewarded for doing exactly that.
Yes, well, that's why you have so many states where it's basically non-existent.
Talk about the unmarried moms for a minute. We've had many years of talking about out-of-wedlock births.
Yeah.
I think people should be unlocked when they're giving birth, but...
Well, we could talk about shackling. That's an issue.
We've had blaming the women. We've had blaming the men. We've had blaming marriage and the threats to marriage. Mm-hmm. Where do you put responsibility? What accounts for this? And first off, who are these women? We have a stereotype the media bring us, but who are they really?
Well, we know that unmarried births have gone up all over the world and among people of all races. We also know factually that in the African American community that 70% of births are to women who aren't married. So the trends in terms of the birth rates have been actually more increases of unmarried births among whites and among Hispanics than among African Americans. But the birth rate is troubling. But, you know, how do you talk about that? And the conservative way, what's the right word? It isn't very conservative. Anyway, the right-wing way of talking about it is to say, well, they ought to get married. You know, no problem. They ought to get married. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, who are they going to marry? And that gets you into a whole lot of other questions about what's the criminal justice system doing to African-American men and who's out there who you could get married to. And I just start, I think that there's a lot of community responsibility that is not being exercised in terms of what goes on in school, what goes on from the faith community, what goes on in a variety of ways to try to promote having essentially young women not having babies until they're somewhat older, and every way that we can to promote. I mean, just having in this economy, just having a second wage earner in the family makes a huge difference in survival. Now, you don't want to just go out and get somebody, it is more complicated. I worry sometimes about people on sort of our side. I'm making an assumption about all of you, but I think it's probably correct. We kind of don't talk about the personal responsibility part of it, but that's only part of it. And you're functioning in this economy where it's so hard to earn enough money, if there were more opportunities, if there were better schools, I mean, you know, all the stuff that we believe in as whatever we are, liberals, progressives, so on, we'd have more people growing up to a life of possibility, and I promise you that we wouldn't have the same kinds of issues about this.
Paycheck equality would help, for one thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how we get from here to another place. Although I have one question before that. You're going to be interviewed by Bill Moyers, and not long ago, he had one of my favorite labor leaders on the show, mm-hmm. Roseanne DeMauro from the National Nurses United. And he asked her at some point, you know, you're great, but how do you account for the rest of the labor movement? Rolling over on so many key issues, including EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, and other things. She talked about class shame. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what you thought of that, talking about what's happened to the labor movement. I wonder more about class divide.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help forgetting that I was in Washington last fall and I spoke to a senior staffer of a congressman who said he had yet to been able to persuade there to be a hearing on unemployment for the full House. And he felt that the segregation, even in Washington, of the staffers and the aides when it comes to class consciousness was so serious that people just weren't feeling the urgency. So I wonder, you know, class shame, class divide, what accounts for?
Well, there is some of that. I think one reason you can't get a hearing with the full House is that who's running the full House. That's maybe more particular. But I think that we have our country generally, and particularly I think it's true in minority communities, that there's a class divide, that people who've made it are, you know, I'm all right, Jack, pull up the gangplank. So it must be their fault, right? I mean, we've heard it in general, and in fact, I think it exists in minority communities. So it's part of the problem. I think that, as I said, with regard to the question of sort of mores about what happens on marriage and having babies. In inner city communities, young people have to fight a peer culture about the value of education. You know, I think we need to face up to these problems and talk about them. So there is that. In the overall politics, I think it's pretty complicated, but I certainly think that as Americans in general, we just don't have a sense enough of how much of these problems is structural. You know, it's complicated. It's partly structural. It's partly personal. People have various kinds of personal problems. It's very judgmental to start putting labels on them.
Did we as a society think about poverty and poverty alleviation differently in the New Deal when it was mostly working class white men who were going to be helped by poverty alleviation strategies?
I take your point.
Just a one question. The Great Society faced different challenges.
Well, the Great Society was a time when there was more of a civil rights ethos to all of this, there was.
It's going to help a whole lot of people of color and women.
Yes. Yeah. No. There was a different look, we've made a lot of change that's good. There's an African-American middle class, much, much stronger. The Latino community, there is the kind of immigrant upward mobility. I think so much of this conversation should be driven by recognition of the economic facts. Yeah. You know, we can say whatever we want about the personal side about it, and obviously I do say some things. But I think fundamentally what we don't deal with, whether they're class attitudes or not, is the fact that as you said in starting the conversation, that half the jobs in this country pay less than $34,000 a year. That's astonishing. Who knows that? The wage since 1973 of the median job in this country has gone up in almost 40 years by a grand total of 7%. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Less than a fifth of a percent a year. You're taking inflation into account, all that. So people have been stuck. And I think what that causes is a lot of anger. Mm. And I think that a lot of the anger of this recession is built up anger. Yeah. Finally coming home to roost when the recession hit so many people.
You talk about the cost the price we pay for not doing something now, for not turning this ship around. What do you say to people of tremendous wealth who've done very well over this period who say, I'm happy in my gated community. Why should I worry about the poor?
I say they ought to pay some taxes. just to start with.
Mm-hmm. They don't respond to the order arguments.
Well, maybe we could legislate it. I mean, you know, maybe not this year, but... But, and it isn't, we're not going to solve the problem by having Warren Buffett's secretary pay as much taxes. I want to do that, have him pay as much taxes as his secretary. But, you know, we really need both on the revenue side to get the money that we should be getting, that people and corporations are capable of paying, and the ones that are hiding the money overseas and, you know, not bringing it here. And we obviously need to look at the expenditure side. So we were talking about Paul Ryan. Not only does he want to slash all of these programs, one after the other, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, all of them, but he wants to raise the defense budget in violation of the disastrous debt agreement last year, but it did anticipate some cuts in the defense budget. He wants to renege on that. And he wants to cut the rich people's taxes more. This is crazy. So I guess that's what I say. I mean, I don't think this is personal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is about paying your fair share.
I think, obviously, you're right. And I think part of the explanation in my mind is that we don't know each other anymore. We live in this segregated society that's segregated in some new ways, and that's one of the things you address in the book. When it comes to creating communities, urban or otherwise, that are more diverse in income, what works?
Well, I think that the... best thing, I mean, I don't know that we're going to create any bringing down of the gates on the gated communities. But certainly we have communities in suburbs and in city after city where there's some diversity. Hope 6 as a housing program, which is complicated because Hope 6 presided over, this was enacted, most of you know, during the Bush period, and it involved demolishing public housing that wasn't functional and replacing it with kind of Newtown-type housing. The thing that was wrong was that we lost something like a million housing units from affordable housing. That ain't good. But you can go around the country and find neighborhoods in many, many cities where when they rebuilt, they're mixed income. And they're successful. And it was, I suppose, primarily it was the intentionality of pricing that made it possible for lower income people to be in those neighborhoods. And they're doing fine. So I think it can be done. And, you know, there are lots of neighborhoods that just naturally have lower incomes. The real worry beyond about poverty, beyond everything we've talked about, I mean, it's one thing to say wages are so low. It's another thing to say so awful, it's so horribly awful about the people at the very bottom. But really the question of concentrated poverty is the whole thing exponentially. And that's where it's really hard to figure out how to change that and get a mix of income. There's so many things that, you know, the schools the kids go to are awful, that we have the cradle to prison pipeline on all of that. And in this world, there aren't a lot of options for people to get out who have, who have that kind of economic situation. So I think our biggest failure over the last 40 years, and we've talked about some pretty awful things, but is if you said, where have we really not made progress? It's about inner city concentrated poverty and also the concentrated poverty of Appalachia, of the Mississippi Delta, of Indian reservations, of people in the colonias of South Texas. Go down to Greenville or Greenwood, actually Greenwood, Mississippi, where Viking stoves are made. And you'll find that there is a block where the Viking stove people have put a hotel that you'd love to go and stay in, as long as you had blinders on. And they have a lovely little bookstore. I hope they have my book down there. Although I don't know who's around that could buy it beyond the people who work at Viking Stoves, because you go two blocks away and there's just horrible poverty. So it's both urban and rural, and it's tough.
The partner of the concentrated poverty is the concentrated wealth.
Yes.
At the end of your book, you talk about the power of people power mm-hmm. to change things, and you have some good things to say about Occupy Wall Street, but not just that. I really want to believe, but do you think people power is a match for the kind of concentrated influence that, I don't know, in this state, Democratic New York, our Democratic governor today said he was going to give up on this session of passing a raise in the minimum wage, and he even said it was more controversial than marriage equality. We've got the Neighborhood Reinvestment Act blamed for the housing debacle. We've got Chief Justice Roberts in David Kirby's story in the New York Times this week saying that desegregation of schools is racist. How do we move forward? In a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, I think all of you ought to write to the governor and urge him to push back on the assembly. And if he can't get it this year, he should be trying to get it next year. We need the state minimum wage to go up everywhere because the federal minimum wage is stuck at $7.25 and it ain't moving anytime soon.
Not just go up, but be indexed, right?
Well, yes, but anyway, let's get what we can get and keep on working on it. Yes, it should be indexed. You're getting a little into the weeds. State minimum wages in high places where the cost of living is pretty high ought to be higher than the federal. And we do have that, but they can go up more. The basic point is really not something where any of us can create the state the blueprint, draw the blueprint. But it really is a combination of people getting to the point, as they did during the Progressive Era, where they are just so sick and tired of the robber barons that they fight back and that they elect somebody different. And I think it's going to take us a while to get out of this. I mean, I'm not going to go off into it. That's not the purpose of this book. But we can get out of this. I think the worst thing is to say, oh, you can't do anything about it. We have a lot of people in this country who care, and we have a lot more if we could get public education out there, I think that the middle and below the middle is ought to be in play here. And I think the basic idea that people still have is they cling, and it's understandable on a human level, they cling to the idea that it is going to be better for their children. I mean, they kind of, that's the proclivity. But as long as they think they have more in common with those people at the top than they do with the people below them, we're cooked.
So maybe we are the 99% motif, and its popularity indicates
that. Well, I like
that.
I always, of course, it's sort of over for the moment, and I hope we can have it come back in a more politically salient way, that SEIU and others can turn that into a politics. But then we have to say, excuse me, it's the whole 99%. It's not 70 and then the other 29.
Right. All right. We're going to take some questions. So feel free to come up to this mic. Emphasis on the word question. I want to hear the question mark at the end of your sentence. Peter has a great line in his book where he says, if he was a Jew exiled from Egypt, he would have discovered the promised land by now. But he's not giving up. And I guess I'm betting you're not either. Love to hear from you, what you think might make a difference. One thing we haven't addressed, Peter, is what could have been done differently in 09 or 08, 09 in terms of responding to the financial crisis.
Well, you're warming up. I do think that the president was too much in bed with Wall Street. I do think that. I'm a great supporter of this president, but I think that he made some bad choices in 2009 that exacerbated the people out on Main Street, if you will, the feeling that there was nobody who was on their side, and I think that actually helped fuel the Tea Party. So, you know, I
specifically like what?
Well, no bonuses, pay back all the money. Those kinds of things, just a more populist, tougher, clearly populist line on that. Secondly, this president, in my view, and again, it's all with 100% support of him going forward, has had trouble taking credit in a public way for things that he did that are really good. Here was some of the things that I mentioned, and other things like Dodd-Frank, and you know these aren't perfect, but they really were very, very important. And the country kind of doesn't know that he did them. You know, everybody got a tax break in the Recovery Act, and nobody knew they'd gotten it. So I think that's a part of the answer to that question.
Well, that gets a little bit to the media question, which I hope somebody will ask. If that could have been one more chapter on what changes civic society.
Yeah. I should have called you. We should have co-authored the book.
All right. First, Avram.
In your estimation, can we grow out of this recession? Or are we now entering a new phase of corporate capitalism where how do we get money down into the lower half of society is something that requires some new kind of way of behavior, new kind of policies?
I think there's a really big question about the future of our economy. I mean, we're in a global economy. And a lot of our future depends on what happens in China and India and other places. I worry about that. And, you know, I've talked to people in various sort of political places, and there's too many people that I respect say that they think we're going to have this many low-wage jobs for a very long time, or too many low-wage jobs for a very long time. And what that says is, I mean, here are kind of my sense of the remedies there, and it's they're not about growing our way out of a completely. I mean, I think we will get some growth, and the economy will not be this bad. But I think that recovery, you know, the recovery from the first George W. Bush recession was anemic, right? And we went through the first 6 years, of, to put it in poverty terms, of the past decade, the first 6 years of his administration, 6 million more people got to be poor while he was president, because it was the weakness of the economy, largely. It wasn't anything that he did to the benefit structure particularly. So I really worry about the low wage. So answers, number one, minimum wage, all right? Number two, unions being stronger. There are a whole bunch of work supports that are income equivalents. Healthcare is worth something, in effect, to the pocketbook. Childcare, housing, help with housing, help with college. I think all of those are public policies that a decent society ought to have. It's a kind of a social obligation to have. They're all worth something in helping people who are having a tough time. The place where I think we've got to start a public, you know, with all the macroeconomic policy that will get us as much growth as we can, there will still be a distributional question. And so I think there needs to be a conversation about wage supplements beyond the earned income tax credit.
Which raises one little question in my mind, then we'll come to the second questioner, which was when those of us who were critics of welfare, quote unquote, reform in 96 mm-hmm. were campaigning, many of us emphasized, well, people just use welfare for a short time. This mm-hmm. is just a temporary help. Was that misguided to emphasize the temporariness when it sounds like you're saying we actually need to understand a long-term commitment?
There are two groups of the poor in this respect. There are two groups of welfare recipients in this respect. If you look at it dynamically over a period of time, 9 out of 10, let's go back to AFDC when there was welfare. 9 out of 10 people who were on welfare were only on for a short spell,
right.
Got off quickly. However, on any let's make a hospital bed analogy. There are two beds. One of the beds has the same patient for 10 days. The other bed has 10 different people, one day apiece. So on any given day, half the people who are in those two beds are there for a 10-day spell. Mm. The other half, but 10 out of 11 only have a one-day spell. That's what the welfare story was.
So we need both beds.
We need both beds, and we need to have a safety net that helps all of these people. The much larger majority of people who ever need cash assistance are going to need it temporarily. So we've made it that when somebody loses the job and their unemployment runs out, or somebody leaves somebody in the lurch, the husband goes away or something like that. We say temporary assistance for needy families, but we don't even do that.
Right.
You go to the welfare office in all of those states, and they say, oh, you look like you could work, get out of here. That's the one. Then we have a small group at the bottom where we just, it isn't very big, but it's what gets all those politicians jumping up and down. Fact is, it wouldn't cost much money at all. It's much more that they want to play the game for the blame game for political purposes.
All right. Or could I have a follow-up?
No, you can't. We love you, but we're moving right on. Keep going.
I'm available afterwards.
So in the next year, a variety of laws and programs are set to expire. Laws that go ahead and tax, let's say, capital or the wealthy.
Yeah.
And then programs that help support low income.
Mm-hmm.
Out of those, or maybe something that's not on the horizon that's being pushed to be brought to the chopping block, what would you say are the most critical? So maybe something that's not even being discussed in the media that you see as far as, let's say, being pushed by certain agendas to be on the chopping block. What do you see as the most critical in that? And then if these programs and laws are set to expire, what do you see as the possible consequences for the economy and socially, politically? Thank you.
The revenue side is huge, of course. I mean, it just the fact that if they don't let the tax cuts for the wealthy expire, right, so that we go back to the pre-2001 levels. That's just awful. And it's awful in an equity sense, and it's awful in a revenue sense. So that's maybe wasn't in your question, although you said it at the beginning. That's the most serious thing, is making sure that those tax cuts expire, that they do expire. We want them to expire, okay? On the program side, if you're just talking about expiration as opposed to Paul Ryan and his cuts, there are a number of things that are important. They're not cataclysmic like the revenue thing. The earned income tax credit has a piece in it for three children. So it's a few more $100 on for you know, somebody who's working in a low-wage job. That's bad to lose it, but it's not disastrous. The child tax credit, the way in which it's calculated temporarily, you start getting the child tax credit when you have $3,000 worth of earnings. If that expires, it goes back to you don't start getting it until you have about $14,000. I won't go into the, I'm already in the weeds, but again, that would cost a poor family $1,000 or so. That's bad for them to lose $1,000. It's not like that expiring tax cut thing. And there are some other things that were in the Recovery Act that are either or actually already gone or slated to go, some extra child care money, some extra housing money, some extra money for the homeless, all of that. The bigger questions are about holding on to the benefits that we have when they come in with the budget acts. It's not the expiring things. It's the things that would be scheduled to continue unless Congress was able to cut them. And you know, the problem with that is not so much what the Senate would do left to its own devices, it's that the House passes some awful thing, and then the Senate passes a good thing, and then they go to conference, and they slice the difference. And it's a reconciliation bill, so it's got, you know, it's got all kinds of stuff in it that are politically important, and depending on what deal they cut, the president signs it. So it's not so much that Paul Ryan gets his way, is that he gets too much of his way, and that's what we really have to worry about.
So we've got three more questions. Let's have the first one, and then because of time, I'm going to ask the second two both to pose your questions, but we'll let Peter sort of wrap up.
Peter, in your discussion, you mentioned that you feel in this country we don't put enough emphasis on structural inequality.
Yeah.
And I would completely agree with that statement. And as such, I wonder how we can shift the narrative in this country from placing the onus on the individual and this whole idea of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps to that there are these larger structural inequalities, and how do we address those rather than just making people feel guilty?
Well, that's Laura's point about the media, isn't it? I mean, there are two ways to get messages out. One is up at the high level, which is essentially the media in all of its ways, that new media and everything, and then organizing and, you know, what happens at the grassroots level to get people activated. And so we just need more people who are talking about all of this stuff. We need to find ways, people who work on these things, to get you know, ministers and priests and rabbis and imams to be talking about it on in their services and sermons, and all the different ways in which we could get more public consciousness of these issues. I just think that in general, especially those people that who I was saying are in the balance, they think it's their own fault. And they have this, as I say, this kind of optimism that it makes me very uncomfortable to challenge it, but to get the reality out there. So I don't have a great answer, but it's a challenge about how do we get more people saying in magnified ways what the truth is. And But, you know, then it's some specific things. Understanding about why the schools are the way they are, understanding about why the criminal justice system is the way it is, taking those structural pieces one by one and tackling them. And they have their own, each of them has its own chemistry. Right now, it's a great time to do something about the criminal justice system because guess what? You could save a lot of money by changing those sentencing structures.
I was struck by a fact in your book that I didn't know, that people incarcerated don't count towards the poverty stats,
yes,
although they do for congressional districting, of course.
Yeah, yeah, right.
All right, two questions, and then we'll let Peter...
So I wish I had a better... That's one of the 64 gazillion dollar questions.
Hi, so we've talked about, from a policy and political and governmental standpoint, some of the structural reasons why things are the way they are. How much, if any, of what we do in our day-to-day life impacts what's happening for the economic lower class? How much of how and where we spend our money, or how much in terms of small-scale philanthropy, middle-class, upper-middle-class people, does it matter, or as long as we're dealing with these big systemic issues, does it matter if we shop at Walmart or shop locally? Does it matter if we spend $100, you know, give $100 to charity or spend $100 on shoes? Or is it just too big for any of that to make much of a difference?
I never want to say that. I think that each of us this is really tremendously about people taking responsibility in every respect for this. Somebody says, you know, what can we do or what can you do? And I mean, the first answer ought to be, what are you going to do in every way, politically, but then in also these other ways that we can configure our the daily decisions that we make in ways that aren't hurtful to people who are already hurting. Now, I don't want to, you know, the specifics about should you ever shop at Walmart, that's a thing in and of itself to decide. But I would never say, oh, what I do doesn't matter. Never. Keep those small gifts coming in.
Thank you very much for speaking tonight. You were talking about segregation of different segments of society. Yeah. What role, if any, in this whole discussion do you feel that today's massive isolation, you know, plays? Whether people are sitting at jobs during the day or at Starbucks on a cell phone, everybody seems to be just alone, like a disconnect.
Yeah.
What do you think about that in relation to what you've been talking about?
Oh, beautiful, thanks.
Well, it is an important question, and I think we've been, at least we should have been, worrying about, remember the lonely crowd? You know, this is not a new issue. It's in a new form, certainly. We've lost community in a lot of ways, in whether we're in a diverse community or whatever community it is, and I think it's sort of not my expertise. I have as much knowledge as you do about it, but it's certainly my feeling that is a part of the issue, to find ways that we would identify more with everybody else and connect better. And I think the technology is, in a couple of respects, the technology is causing us to be much more sort of self-contained and communicate in ways that are, you know, not face-to-face, et cetera. That's all. That's not good.
Grace Lee Boggs in Detroit says the collapse of the auto industry means we actually walk from place to place and meet our neighbors.
Yes.
We want to let Peter sell his book at the back there. He's willing to sign it, right?
Yes.
And the book is a great, great refutation, both of those who say nothing can be done and of those who say nothing should be done. The argument for and the argument why it's possible are both in the book. Peter, thank you so much.
Laura, thank you very much.
My honor.